You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift and separate them above the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, let me tell you, this is a show where two friends get together and talk about movies, something that these two friends have probably been doing for over 40 years. We just decided we would share our knowledge with you, and we would like to hear your insight as well if you ever want to volunteer it. If you are returning, you already know this. This is an unscripted podcast. You will hear us stammer and stutter sometimes because we have no script. We just watch these movies a few days in advance, and we pontificate, for lack of better words, not really, about them.
Yeah, I mean, to the point we don't even discuss either. We don't pre-plan and say, you take this, I'll take this, you take this. It's just like, we having a talk on it. Let's go.
Well, and there's an advantage to having known you as long as I have, because we probably know what each other are going to say.
Pretty much.
And speaking of which, this is my good friend David Horton, and he is my co-host here as well. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm excited because I'm really liking the topic for this one. So we'll have a good one once we get there. But we usually start by saying, you know, what have we done in our genre week? So those of you who are revisiting have heard that before. Those of you who are new, we talk about something genre related that we've done in the past week. And for me, it's interesting because it should be, here's my soapbox. It should be totally science fiction that I have done this past week, but it's not, and that's what I'm on my soapbox about. So, I delved into the latest season of Black Mirror.
Uh-oh.
You've heard of Black Mirror, right?
I've heard, yes. On another podcast I listened to, when they talk about it, someone, you know, a science fiction person calls in and they'll be like, the first three seasons are great. They lost it in one. They got it back here. And then, you know, they're unsure about the next one. It's like it's always fluctuating.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it started out as a BBC series. Yeah. It only had like, I think three. Almost all of them, I can't say all because I haven't done the total research on it, but almost all of them are written by Charlie Brooker. And Brooker was a really well-known kind of writer, producer in England. He started it years and years ago, and they only had like three episodes per season for the first two seasons. And then it was essentially canceled, but it was picked up by Netflix. And they got it, and they started doing six episodes, mm-hmm. or eight episodes, or whatever.
Or a movie. Didn't they do a movie, too?
Okay, now Bandersnatch is different, because Bandersnatch, they produced, it's a movie with multiple variations to it. It's like those old books you get to get when you go, you can either go to space or stay on the planet. What do you pick? If you pick space, go to page 52. If you pick planet, go to page 84. And then you go and you read the rest part of the story, and then you get a choice again. It's done like that.
Do you fast
the movie
forward
is done like that.
On your remote?
No.
Oh.
No, on your device, whatever you're watching, it comes up and you get to decide, are you going to do this or this?
Weird.
And whatever you decide determines the rest of the story.
Strange.
Kind of thing. Huh. And it's very interesting. And I think there's five different endings you can get depending on how you play it. So it's almost like a game and a movie at the same time. And it's pretty good. It's not bad. Some of them were a couple of cop-outs endings on it. I've seen all five.
Well, I'm sensing that ever since Netflix took over, that the quality's gone down maybe. I don't know. Has it?
The quality has been... Okay, another soapbox, but the quality's been Americanized.
Okay.
The thing about the BBC was that it was very in-your-face, kind of uncensored kind of stuff that – and some stuff that was European, so you kind of go, I'm not sure what's going – oh, now I get what's going on here. It took you a minute. You know, whereas since Netflix has taken over, very, very Americanized approach to the storytelling and the direction and everything else. But the premise of it – was always, this is technology taken to an extreme that is terrifying. That's essentially my take on Black Mirror. It was always about technology. It was always about technology being taken to some weird extreme that you're not aware of and how that is actually terrifying. Like, there's one entire episode, and Bryce Dallas Howard is actually in it. This is after it went to America. But basically, it's this takeoff of phones and how we judge everyone. And essentially, anybody you run into in the world, you can swipe your phone and either give them points or take away points from them. So their value in society is determined by their point calculus on their phone.
Okay.
Even down to the fact that she makes one little mistake, all these people throw it up over social media, everybody has an opinion. So as she's walking down the street, people are pulling points away from her. So by the time she gets back home, her rent has tripled and she can't afford it anymore. Because your rent is based on how popular you are.
It's like a jab at social media.
Correct. Yeah. And all that. So, and there, you know, there's another one that's even better. Anyway, what I loved about it was, you know, there's one where, one of my favorites where everybody in the world gets an implant in one of their ear, in one of their eyes. And these implants record everything you see all day long. So for the police, they can access that if you're under warrant and they put you in a device and they can see the crime that either you committed or you witnessed. So they have a video record of it, which is great. However, this particular situation, this guy starts being jealous of his wife. So he starts playing back stuff for her. Like when they get home, he's playing back going, why were you talking to this guy at the party? What were you saying to him over in the corner? Cause I watched you. And it gets into this all societal thing of voyeurism and how voyeurism can be taken to the extreme. Blah, blah. Excellent storytelling. Great science fiction. Great acting. Da, da, da. The last one I watched had a fucking werewolf in it. I was going, since when is a werewolf in freaking Black Mirror? What the hell? It's, that has nothing to do with technology going berserk.
It's not a wolf from the Cala, is it? They were robots.
if that had turned out that way, I would have been happy. But it didn't. You know, it made me so mad because the last two, I have not finished the season and I'm struggling. The last two I've watched have been Supernatural. And that is so against what Black Mirror always was. You know, leave that to something else. Leave that to Twilight Zone.
Well, I was going to say, the show has always been compared to Twilight Zone. Maybe they thought they could get away with it. I don't know.
No, well, they can't, in my opinion. So that was my firm foot down saying, Mr. Brooker, please don't do any more Supernatural with Black Mirror. If you've run out of ideas for science fiction, there's plenty of novels and books and short stories.
I was going to say, there's other writers out there. You just can't use them right now.
Correct. But well, not until the strike is over. Right. But yes, yeah, so that's what I've been doing. I've been being pissed off about Black Mirror. Get off my lawn.
Nah.
All right. What about you?
Well, in my genre week, I decided to tailor it specifically to what our topic of the day is.
Ooh.
So I went and watched a little movie from 1978. Called Coma.
Ooh, gosh, I have not seen that since the theater.
Well, it's not as good as you remember it.
Oh, dang.
Like our topic today, this movie is directed by Michael Crichton. It was written by Michael Crichton based on the book by Robin Cook. Mm-hmm. Now, this book, I remember, was a huge bestseller.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about seeing that paperback copy of The Exorcist always on a table somewhere. Well, I always saw a copy of Coma right next to it, pretty much, in the 70s. Those were two huge best-selling books. And this was a very successful movie, from what I remember. I seem to remember this movie being popular. I can't find accurate financial stats on it, so I'm not sure. But it,
I always remember it because it was Michael Douglas and Genevieve Bugeaud, and I loved her name because it made me sound like I was French.
Like you were French when with that outrageous accent, you silly
with that outrageous accent, yes.
as you said, it stars Genevieve Bugeaud, Michael Douglas. It has Rip Torn. It has Richard Widmark in it.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Big stars. And it even has Tom Selleck and Ed Harris in small roles, which blew my mind.
That would have mine too, yeah.
So it's not as great a movie now. Let me rephrase that. The second half of this movie is really good. The first half of this movie is like going to med school. You're basically being taught how hospitals operate, what equipment is for, and all this stuff. And it gets really tedious at times.
Welcome to anesthesiology.
Exactly. There is a part where it is an anesthesiology lesson.
Of course.
Because
that's essential to the plot.
Well, it is essential to the plot. But I guess we take it for granted that most of us know about this stuff now because it's on the internet or it's been on ER or Chicago Hope or Grey's Anatomy or any of those shows that everybody watched for years and years and years.
Well, I seem to remember this was the first time I learned that there are mixtures to your anesthesia. Mm-hmm. I always thought that anesthesia, you know, was like laughing gas. They just give you knockout gas and you go to sleep. But it's not. It's your body chemistry and it's a mixture. And sometimes it's an injection along with the, you know, blah, 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 all this stuff. And I learned that in COVID.
And it's gas and liquid. I didn't know that. And there's the magic milk stuff that Michael Jackson was very fond of. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Propofol.
Yes. And that's the stuff they used when you get like a, what do you call that?
Colonoscopy.
I couldn't think of the name of it. But yeah, they give you that stuff, man. You sleep like nothing else. That's the best sleep in the world. And that's why Michael Jackson loved it. Anyway, back to the topic of Coma.
As opposed to colon.
Yeah.
Yes.
I read that whether or not this was a runaway success, it definitely made its money back because it was filmed for a little over $4 million based on a $3 million television deal. So they knew it was going to go to television. So it kind of offset their budget.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then it probably went on to make money in the theaters as well. I'm guessing. The synopsis is a young doctor at a hospital, Susan Wheeler, starts noticing a pattern of strange occurrences with patients. Healthy patients are suddenly developing complications and ending up in comas. She starts investigating, and what she reveals is astonishing. Now, there's a big spoiler. It's 45 years old, and I will tell you what it is right now.
Or stop and go watch it and come back. Yeah.
It's organ harvesting. They are basically putting young, healthy people into comas and selling their organs overseas and to other hospitals. So that's what it is.
Yeah.
This movie scores 81% on Rotten Tomatoes. I would give it that to the latter half is very suspenseful. It is shot really well. Crichton knows how to build suspense. It's just the first half that is kind of boring. So that is my summation of 1978's Coma.
Well, and he was a doctor, right? I mean, he was a medical doctor before he became a novelist.
He was a medical student. I think Cook was a doctor. I read that somewhere when I was doing a little bit of research on this. I don't think Crichton ever practiced. I think. Because he was already writing for Hollywood. I mean, he wrote before he started writing science fiction. He wrote The Great Train Robbery. So he was already like kind of trying to work his way into Hollywood, even if he was a med student.
Yeah. But you know, it's kind of the perfect blend for him and Cook to get together on this. And, you know, and it's interesting that you said television deal, because that will come into play as we talk about the topic of the day.
Right.
Because I do think Michael Crichton is a very ambitious writer. And I think you mentioned when we did
Jurassic
Park. Jurassic, because you reread it, that you really liked the book. Mm-hmm. And the way it was written, not that it was necessarily translated the best in the film, even though the film's good, kind of thing. But Crichton doesn't have a good history as a director and is very television in his directing style, I think. Mm-hmm. He may be a great writer, but I don't think he ever should have directed, really. My kind of take on it. And I say that because, and you'll see it in what we're dealing with today, because we are going to go back to 1973 today and delve into one of Crichton's first big works, which is a little thing called Westworld, which I'm excited about just because, and you'll have to rein me in and stop me because I'll constantly make references to the series.
Stop it.
Those of you who listen to us regularly know that I am so against reboots and remakes and all that kind of stuff, with the exception of the first season of Westworld and probably the first two seasons of Battlestar Galactica. Those are both really great reimaginations of classic works that were turned into even much more brilliant later works. But we are talking about the original. The movie came out in 1973, of course, like I said, written and directed by Michael Crichton.
It's his debut.
Yes.
I mean, this is the first movie he directed. Coma, he had already had a couple under his belt.
And the storyline is fairly basic and easy to tell quite succinctly and quickly. Basically, it's set in the near future where technology has reached the point that can create lifelike robots. Those robots, are created by and overseen by some dark, mysterious corporation called Delos. Delos has set up amusement parks for adults. For this, one is Roman world, one is medieval world, and the titular West world. We follow two primary characters who go to West world. One has been there several times before. The other one is on his first visit. So naturally, he's our glimpse from the audience perspective of how to experience this world. It's a totally lifelike recreation, and what could possibly go wrong? And that was the big poster tagline for it, where nothing can possibly go wrong. And naturally, something possibly goes wrong. The robots go berserk and start killing the guests and attacking everyone. And we follow our protagonist as he is hunted relentlessly by a gunslinger robot until the end, when he can finally defeat him. When was the first time you saw this movie? I know you've seen it before, but when was the first
time? Oh, my gosh. Well, it would have 73. I would have been too young to see it in the theater, probably. So, yeah, I saw it on television. I'm certain I saw it on television because I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the distinct things I remember is it's pre $6 Million Man, but there's a lot of $6 Million Man to it as far as keys, like the removing of a face and it being robotic behind. Terrified me as a kid. We didn't mention it, but we're in October and I was having a hard time picking scary sci-fi movies for Halloween. And I picked this one because it did scare me as a kid. I thought
it does have some shock jump scares to it.
There's a menace to it and it's being stalked by a killer basically. So there's definitely some horror elements to it. Now, I do want to also point out, and you won't remember this, but since I'm always going through our old archives, I covered this movie a few years back as a genre topic of the week during our Wrath of Khan episode.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So this rewatch I did for this podcast today was a rewatch after I had rewatched it about 2 years ago. So I've seen it twice here recently. And
interesting.
And I love it. I love this movie. It's cheesy. It's television-y, but I really love this movie. I just think it's a great movie compared to what it spawned as far as that future world sequel and maybe a television series that wasn't the HBO show. I can't remember. But
agreed. Yeah. Yeah. There was a short-lived, like, 6-episode television series. Yeah. There was the sequel, Future World. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Nolan and Joy took it over to HBO, and they commissioned probably one of the best seasons of science, the best seasons of television other than the, you know, the original series of Star Trek. It's my second favorite probably ever.
Yeah, it's a shame Babylon 5 Michael Crichton died, because I would have loved for him to have seen it.
Yes. Yeah. The exploration that they get into is so much better than this, or taken from this and mutated on. I originally saw this in the theater.
Okay.
I saw this in the theater, loved it, saw it, I think, 3 times in the movie theater. I remember distinctly a personal story because I also, in between the first time I saw it and the second time I saw it, the paperback came out. And all it was a novelization of the script. There was no novel this was based on, which confused me for years. Because I said for years, well, no, it was a novel that he wrote and he turned it into a movie. Mm-hmm. No, they published a
movie tie-in.
He was the guy who used to do it for Star Trek, Alan Dean Foster, you know, kind of.
He did it for
Alien.
I took
the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if they're called movie tie-ins. David Seltzer used to do them too. He did one for The Omen because I always thought The Omen was a book and it was a movie tie-in. Yeah.
There you go. And, but so the second time I went to see it, I had read the book. And I took the book with me to the movie theater with Wynn Thompson and irritated the shit out of him because I kept reading the lines ahead of the scenes.
That is very irritating, but of course it's easy to irritate Wendell.
Yeah, that's true. But he got so mad at me. He goes, man, don't tell me. Don't tell me the line. Don't tell me the line. And I would say the line. He goes, man, I said don't do it. Just don't do it. Anyway, looking back at it, so I loved it. I'm the same way as you. It has a special place in my heart. It has a special place in my science fiction heart, because I thought this was one of the first times I thought science fiction was totally plausible. Modern technology. You know, it's interesting that my genre topic was Black Mirror, because this is a Black Mirror story. Technology run amok. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is a Black Mirror kind of story. And that's one of my keys to it is from it, because I think this is totally, totally plausible. Look at the amount of sex bots there are happening now. You know, there will be, we will have, humanistic robots, either domestically as our servants or as some form of pleasure bots that we can go and have an experience
with. Yeah, instead of OnlyFans, these people will be licensing their images for sex robots.
Oh, yeah. Oh, easily. Easily. And there's so many keys that will come out of this that we'll get to later on. But, you know, the first one, and I think we've got to just mention it because we're going to talk through it, the movie is Disney. This is animatronics taken, animatronics gone crazy sort of thing. I find it very interesting that a few weeks ago we did Stepford Wives. Mm-hmm. And this is the same thing
also
again.
Also October, this is, scary movie.
Yep.
Robots equal scary, I guess. I don't know.
If taken wrong, yes. Yeah.
In the 70s.
Production of it, before we get into scenes and stuff.
Sure. I've got a little bit. I know that it was filmed in 30 days and released in 5 months. So, I mean, after that 30 days, it was released 5 months later. That's really fast. But it was one of MGM's biggest box office hits of the year because it only cost a little over $1 million to make and it grossed 10. So that was a big hit. Mm-hmm. That's why you saw things spawned from it, whether it be a bad sequel or a television show.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a huge hit for them, and it wasn't supposed to be. I mean, Crichton had specific – so Crichton had actually written Andromeda Strain, mm-hmm. and it had already been produced. It came out in '69?
Well, and that was a book before it was a movie.
Correct.
It was not a tie-in.
He had written it, mm-hmm. turned into a movie. You and I think even first season I was saying, you know, when people ask me what's the ultimate science fiction movie mm-hmm. – you know, watch Andromeda.
Yeah,
that's science fiction.
It's ripe for a redux, as far as I'm concerned. And that's Robert Wise, too, who is just one of the best yep. directors America ever produced. So,
and it's a great movie. It's a great book. It's a great adaptation. He did make a directorial debut, I have in my notes, in 1972 with a movie called Pursuit. But it did not garner half the attention that this one did. He had said at the time he would never, ever take a script to MGM because MGM at the time had the reputation for really meddling with stuff. They would request rewrites. They would have a say-so in the marketing, in the production, in the casting, everything. They were so involved. I think MGM at this time was paranoid about losing the studio system, and they knew it was coming. So they were exerting all this control. When they would do a film, he said he would never go to MGM. He shopped it around all over town. Nobody wanted it. He ended up making the deal with MGM. And true to form, they demanded rewrites almost every day, almost every week. Scenes rewritten, scenes restructured, all this kind of stuff. And he had no say-so whatsoever in the casting. The director and the writer had no say-so in the casting. And two of the cast, like Yul Brynner and James Brolin, were not cast until a week before he started
shooting. I did read that. Yeah.
Yep.
But I'll say kudos to MGM because this movie didn't sell itself. So they put in a good marketing campaign on this to make it the hit it was.
Yeah.
They had to.
And I think that's why they picked, you know – but another reason, because of the budget, I think that's why they picked TV actors for most of this.
Well, yeah, and you're right. I mean, they are TV actors, except for Yul Brynner. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll get to that with casting. But, they, you know, so they cast TV actors in it. It does have some good stuff to it mm-hmm. as far as production-wise. Mm-hmm. The big first being this was the first use of digital, what they call digital image processing. You know, we talked about how Jurassic, the very beginning of this season, we talked about how Jurassic really revolutionized CGI. But basically, this was pixelated imagery. This had never been done before. Mm-hmm. And it had to be done frame by frame. So all of this was done with a process that took weeks and weeks to do. Even so much so that it was happening while they were shooting other scenes so that they could get it done in time because this movie was released really quickly. Mm-hmm. So it was the first use of that, and it's fairly effective. It's one of my favorite scenes is the any scene that is from his point of view and the way they do that from the beginning when they're in the desert to the torch. Now the torch distracts him because of the
heat.
Well,
it's not just digitized. It's also infrared. So you've got like two special effects going on, really, when you think about it.
Well, it's the same special effect. It's just they give the image of visual and heat sense.
Right, right.
That, yes, by the way they pixelate the image and colorize it.
You were talking about background, and it just occurred to me. I did not have this in my notes, but I mentioned that it really didn't cost that much to make. It cost a little over $1 million, but it made $10 million. Well, one of the reasons it was so cheap is because they didn't have to build any sets. All of that stuff was backlot. It was from old westerns in the 50s and 60s. So
three basic locations. Yeah, three basic locations: the MGM backlot, the Mojave Desert, and then they used Harold Lloyd's estate for Roman mm-hmm. World. Because it was so, you know, plantational, gorgeous, fountains, all that, statues, everything. So they used his house to shoot Roman World.
Well, and apparently his house was part of the studio backlot, or became a part of the studio backlot.
Eventually, yeah. Yes.
And he was a big silent film actor, I guess, that was loaded.
Not guess. Yeah, he was both. Yeah. He was Harold Lloyd. The classic image is him hanging off the clock. The clock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, Harold Lloyd was great. I love the fact that they use that. Mm-hmm. You can actually see other, you know, there's a lot of keys in the fact of these sets that they're using. And you can see them used in other things. I mean, those panels in the control room. Oh, Irwin Allen bought those bad boys and he uses those in everything, you know.
And speaking of television, wow.
Oh, yeah. The bar, the back lot, the city street itself. The only other thing I've got from a production angle is that MGM immediately wanted a sequel. It was so popular. They immediately wanted a sequel. They started into negotiations. They even started into pre-production. And then they backed out because they got another little property called Logan's Run. And they decided they would devote everything to that and was going to make billions of dollars.
Okay, I have a question.
And so this, yeah.
Why do all of these science fiction movies coming out in the 70s look like television? Because that one does too.
Cheap. Yes. Cheap, easy, and fast.
Okay.
You know, that was the way they did it. And, you know, and it shows. Unfortunately, it does not date well at all and shows up horribly. Anyway, that's why the sequel, which was called Future World, was produced by AIP. Another American International.
Yeah, yeah. We cover it on one of our top fives because you said Blythe Danner's in it. I remember that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it. If I have, I repressed it. I don't remember it.
It was not good.
No.
It had some great ideas, and that's what Nolan and Joy take some of that for season two of Westworld, the series. They take a lot of those ideas of, well, if you have these perfect robots, why don't you start impersonating people? You know, do Stepford with it. Why don't you start taking, like, key political figures and replacing them with robots that you can control? And that's what Delos starts doing. So, yeah, it's that.
Yeah, but even the trailer of that movie looks bad.
Oh, yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's not a good movie.
And it looks like an Irwin Allen movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It looks like a disaster movie, literally, in several regards.
All right, as far as scenes, what any of the scenes stand out to you in Westworld?
I want to hear what you think. What are your scenes that you like?
Well, you know the majority of the scenes I'm going to like is when Yul Brynner is after Richard Benjamin. I mean, that's when it gets scary. All right, but specifics, I love the scene where Richard Benjamin is on the horse and runs into the dude out on the golf cart or whatever, saying, oh, he's after mm-hmm. you? Then you better run because he's not going to stop. You're dead.
Yeah, you don't have a prayer, dude. Yeah, if he's a 5,000 model or whatever he says, yeah.
And I can't think of that actor's name, but he's a TV actor, too.
Yep, they all are. Dick Van Patten, all of them.
Yeah.
And they have the, you know, he has, but he sets up so much of a key that I'll bring up later on, but with this whole thing, if he's this model, this is the only way to stop him. You might be able to do this to cut down on his sensory. You might be able to do this to cut down on that. Yeah. You might be able to, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, all right. Check those boxes later
which
on.
Which leads me to another scene I like, which is when he throws the acid in his face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't really do much damage.
We had talked, when we did Exorcist, we talked about the fact that, you know, it motivated me so much I wanted to get into prosthetic makeup and do all that and got Dick Smith's kit and all that. This one was great because they experimented for days and days and weeks on what would work for the acid. And nothing was working right. And Yul Brynner wasn't comfortable with stuff. You know, if they used too much chemical, he didn't like it. You know, so that sort of thing. They eventually ended up taking Alka-Seltzer and crushing it up and putting it in the makeup, the powdered makeup. And they put that on his face so that when they hit it with real water, it bubbled up and boiled. And that's how they got that effect.
That's
that
awesome.
And a smoke machine. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was so cool and so simple. Yeah. I was going, we can do that. And I actually did that in a couple of short films. I, you know, used Alka-Seltzer as burn makeup. sort of thing. Yeah.
Funny. I have one other scene that stands out to me that I can think of. And it's more for Western reasons than sci-fi. And it's it's the scene where Yul Brynner, you know, they have the duel in the bar and he kills him. Later on, Brolin and Richard Benjamin are sleeping with women, I guess, in separate rooms, or maybe Benjamin's taking a bath. And Yul Brynner shows up in the room with James Brolin, and Richard Benjamin's outside the door and knows he's in there. And they do it in like slow-mo, and he's in a towel only. So it's like, you know, naked gunfighter kicking down the door, going in, and just blasting the hell out of Yul Brynner, and Brynner doing the whole backup thing through the glass, and then cut to the outside where you see the window shatter and him tumbling down the roof and hitting the dirt. It's just like right out of a John Ford Western or Sam Peckinpah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I love that scene. That one stands out to me a lot.
That's one of mine, definitely. Okay. And yes, I've got in my notes very Peckinpah just because of the blood squibs, which this movie does have great squibs, but bad blood. It has that red Italian. Dawn of
the Dead blood.
Yeah, freaking red cherry paint. Kool-Aid blood.
It's like red paint. That's what it is.
My scenes would be, I really like the way they do the second scene of the opening, not the first scene, because that was an MGM thing. The movie was supposed to open just with the hovercraft and the hovercraft scenes, but instead MGM added that silly ass stupid newscaster. I'm here interviewing people who just came from Westworld. What did you think, sir? That sort of reporter exposition shit that they added. I did not like that, but I do like all the scenes aboard the hovercraft and the way they give that exposition. Benjamin, and it establishes, I think, both of them really well, too, because you can tell he's new because he's asking all the questions about, well, how heavy are they? You know, about 2 pounds. Really? That heavy? Wow. Yeah. You know, and can you shoot other people? No, you can't shoot other. What are you talking about? You know, just their dialogue is very great and feels like sets them up great as friends who are used to each other, going to have a good time, yada, yada. They establish the other characters too. You see the Dick Van Patten character being this nebbish little guy with glasses. You see the other older guy and his wife, and obviously they're not on good terms right now, and they're going to separate parks.
Yeah, I can't think of his name, but he's the one that ends up in medieval world.
He's in medieval, she's in Roman. Yeah.
Okay.
But so I like that scene. I love the first, you mentioned it, the first Yul Brynner bar fight scene. You know, somebody needs to get this boy a bib, you know, kind of thing. You might be running home to mama.
Right. It's like he's taunting him.
Oh, he's supposed to. That's the gag.
Yeah.
Side tangent, that's a key. There's a scene in Westworld, the series, in the first season when an old prospector comes, because they have the same thing. One guy is new, never been there before. One guy has been there several times. And the first night they're there, this prospector comes up to him and the new guy starts to listen to him. And the guy who's been there before, his friend looks at him and goes, look, man, no, don't get involved. He'll put you on a stupid ass side quest mission. It doesn't ever go anywhere. Don't get involved. And he goes, but he says he's hurt and he needs help. And he goes, it doesn't matter. It doesn't help the overall story. So don't do it. And he goes, and in typical HBO Westworld, you know, Nolan style, he says, yeah, no, I think I want to go with him. And the guy just pulls out a knife and slits the prospector's throat and says, okay, now you don't have to go with him. Okay, fine. Let's go on. And you go, oh my God. But it's the same kind of thing where the gunslinger probably always does this. He picks a guy, bumps into him and taunts him until he shoots him. That's his arc. That's his story. You know. Second scene I like in my list is the first night repairs, what I call it. And I love that scene.
Yeah. I
love the music. They're using that electronic music and it's kind of creepy-esque kind of feel. And it shows the whole, you know, town at night. And all of a sudden a big car with a light comes in and you're going, That doesn't look out of place in Westworld.
No, it's like, I guess everyone's asleep, and this is what happens at 3 o'clock yeah. in the morning or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, and they pick up the bodies of the robots of that the have dead been dead.
People. Yeah.
Even the robot horses, which you see a horse on the table, which I thought was mm-hmm. cool, and all of that. I just thought that whole scene was really neat. And then it's just them going on about, well, what happened? Oh, the balance servo went out again. Yeah, just put a new one in. And the other guy going, I think while we've got her opened up, we'll put an upgrade in. He goes, well, you could push it farther up into the cavity if you want to do. It was really cool. Just the dialogue works. The scene works. It's showing that this happens every night. This is what happens behind the scenes. They're picking up the, you know, and his key, you know, it's again, it's a, I've said it before. I'll say it's a secondary key for it, but his key for this was Disney World. Underneath Disney World, all these tunnels and everything. That's why he decided he would just use tunnels and redress them for all these scenes and save on money. So all these scenes underground from the arrival when they're on the carts and they each go to a different colored section to the repair area, which is also where he fights the gunslinger at the end, which is also where he runs from the gunslinger down all this maze of court. That's the same set redressed over and over and over and over again. Same two walls.
No surprise. Kind
of, which is really cool. So first night repair is what I call it. And then I'd already said robot vision. I said the opening scene. I said the first Yul Brynner. Oh, and my last one is, of course, for me, especially at that age when I watched it on film, a girl robot that, you know, you can like have sex with and stuff. Really? That was kind of cool. And I like the way he did the big jump scare with her eyes being silver, you know, underneath him kind of thing, just opening all of a sudden and they look real dazed and they're silver and glossy and all that. I like that. And I like the girl at the end. I like the surprise twist with the robot girl at the end in Medieval World. I thought that was a really cool gag.
I just thought of another thing. It's not really a scene, but it's a part of the whole chase at the end. I love it when Richard Benjamin is running and all of a sudden worlds start overlapping. And they're like, he's running through the desert. He's in the water. Yeah. All of a sudden you're seeing Roman columns and stuff. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah. The transition.
He's like on the border of the other world or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating. That kind of shit would have done it for me as a kid. I would have
loved that. And he got to visit all three, which was interesting.
Yeah.
I did find it weird from a storytelling standpoint of he's never been to this park before. So how does he know where the hell he's going? He's just running. I got that impression. But then he stops at some big manhole cover just to go down it for no reason. I don't know why.
It was almost like he knew that manhole cover was there.
Right.
Yeah.
And if there needed to be something to give us that ahead of time, I thought.
He should have just come across it accidentally. But yeah.
And it'd be open. And him think, why is that there and open? And there's a dead technician laying beside it maybe or something. Even that. In our face would have helped, I thought. There were a couple of those kind of glitches where you're going, okay, we just did that for the story, right? kind of thing. And you didn't have to rewrite that scene, did you, Michael? What else? I've got some watch notes stuff or casting, whichever one you want to go to. I don't care.
Let's go to casting.
Okay.
Well, because we've been talking about this television cast. Let's get through it. Actually, the first member of this cast is Yul Brynner, who, as we know, is the only member of this cast that's not really a television movie actor. He is from big movies like The King and I, The Ten Commandments, The Magnificent
Seven. Who is this Moses?
That's actually Billy Crystal. I'm not sure if that's really him or not.
No, that's Yul Brynner.
Yeah. I just remember Billy Crystal making fun of him.
He did it all the time.
He was also in The Magnificent Seven, which is a Sam Peckinpah movie, isn't it? I think it is.
Yes.
Yeah. I found out something about this that really kind of blew my mind. I mean, I didn't think it makes sense, but it's weird. Jack Kirby, the famous illustrator from Marvel Comics, and, you know, Stan Lee had a partnership with him at one time, used Brynner's physical likeness, noticeably the bald head, as the visual inspiration for Professor Charles Xavier in X-Men.
That's a great key. That's cool.
I mean, it's a key. It's kind of a peripheral key, I guess you would say, because it has nothing to do with this movie. I just think it's interesting that he used Yul Brynner as inspiration for that. Mm-hmm. And he was 40. It was in 1963, and Brynner was 43 at the time. Of course, he was probably on Broadway doing King and I or something. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's our star. Now mm-hmm. we move on to the latter characters. Richard Benjamin, who is our final girl, I guess you would say, in this movie.
And Christian Bale.
Right. There's a little bit of a overlap here, and I had meant to mention this in The Stepford Wives, and I forgot. But mm-hmm. Richard Benjamin has been married to Paula Prentice since 1961.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yes, they are both still alive, which, I mean, that's a long marriage. 1961 to now, I can't even think. It's like, what, it's over 60 years. Mm-hmm. So they've been married a long time. Paula Prentice, mm-hmm. of course, played Joanna's friend in The Stepford Wives. And we mentioned mm-hmm. that she was replacing Joanna Cassidy in that role. Anyway, Richard Benjamin, Paula Prentice. Richard Benjamin, I associate with comedies. I do not associate Always. Him with dramas.
Ever.
He was a Ever. Comedic actor. And yet yep. here he is, you know, being stalked to be murdered in a movie called Westworld. He was in movies like The Sunshine Boys, Catch 22, yes. Diary of a Mad Housewife. You just don't really picture him in this movie. And I guess I made the mistake of saying TV actor because he's obviously not a television actor. He's been in films as well. He's a director, too.
Oh, he directed, he did one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah. You want to tell him?
My favorite year.
Yeah, Peter O'Toole.
Yeah.
But he also directed Mermaids, which was a huge hit for Cher.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. He directed that movie as well. So, a lot going on with Mr. Benjamin. Now we really come to our first television actor, and that is James Brolin.
The James Brolin, yes.
He is the James Brolin, but he's probably more famous because of his relations. He's been Mr. Barbra Streisand since 1998, and he's the father of Thanos, Josh Brolin.
Yep.
So he is the big daddy to the big villain in the Avengers movies.
And in this movie, he could be a twin for Christian Bale. He could be Christian Bale's brother in this movie.
You know, I hadn't really thought about it, but he does look a little bit like him. Yeah.
That's why I said it. He looks so much like him this entire movie. I kept going, oh my God, Christian Bale could do a remake of this.
Yeah. James Brolin, though not famous, and he has done a few films, not just television, but he's done a few. But he has 142 acting credits.
Yeah.
I remember him most growing up from Marcus Welby. My mother used to watch that show, and he was the assistant, or I guess you would say the secondary lead of that show with Robert Young.
Yep.
He was the second doctor. Yeah, they were doctors. It was one of the first doctor shows I remember. And he credits Robert Young as being his mentor. Robert Young, of course, was also Father Knows Best.
Makes sense. That makes total sense.
It's not the first science fiction, or it's not the only, excuse me, the only science fiction movie he did in the 70s. He also did Capricorn 1, which is on our list.
Yep. Can't wait to do that one. That'll be fun.
And then, of course, he did a very famous horror movie that is also on our list, and that's The Amityville Horror, which we have not done yet. All of these are 70s movies, all of them. He screen tested. Now, this I did not know. James Brolin screen tested for the role of James Bond in Octopussy.
Hmm.
I don't think he would have made, I mean, he could have been a decent Bond, I think. He's not British.
He would have been that Pierce Brosnan sort of look, mm-hmm. I guess, maybe. Yeah. He could have, yeah.
Well, he was ruled out when Roger Moore agreed to reprise the role. So it was when Roger Moore was kind of flim-flamming about whether or not he was going to do it.
Yeah, and they were wanting to lean more toward a Pierce Brosnan type. Yeah, that makes sense. Yep.
Right. Is Pierce Brosnan American? I think – no, he's not.
No, he's British.
Because, I mean, to cast James Brolin in that role would have been weird because he's American.
Well, Sean Connery is Scottish, so –
But he's still, you know, British.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's still, I don't know. That's just the way my mind works. There were other people enrolled to play or in line to play this role. Amongst the names originally play, and this is actually both actors. These are interchangeable. James Caan.
Okay.
Movie actor. Lee yep. Majors, television actor.
Television actor.
Elliot Gould, movie actor. John Voight. James Franciscus.
Oh.
Peter
yep.
Graves.
Definitely a television actor. Yep.
These are all 70s B-movie actors. That's what they mm-hmm. have in common to me. Or maybe yeah, not John Voight or James Caan, but the others are. Peter yeah. Graves and Leslie Nielsen. Wouldn't fun to see Leslie in this after Forbidden
no,
Planet.
No.
However, all of these proved to be unavailable during the filming dates or way too expensive to hire. The then 42-year-old William Shatner, Captain Kirk from Star Trek, the original mm-hmm. series, was also contemplated by the studio. I would have loved to have seen Shatner.
I would have loved to have seen that. I think that would have been great, actually. Yeah.
He would have been much more inventive of like trying to escape and not get killed. That's for sure. It would have been like the whole arena episode with the Gorn out in the desert.
That is, yeah, that would have been interesting. I would love
actually,
to
that's a good that, key actually. Now that I think about it. he was contemplated by the studio, but they struggled with ideas as who to cast alongside him. So they eventually decided to cast two young unknowns so as to make Yul Brynner remain the star of the film.
Makes sense.
And that's why they went with Brolin and Richard Benjamin, who are relatively unknown, or at least were when I saw this movie.
At this time, yes, they were.
And then I also have that note that both of these actors were cast less than 48 hours before filming was scheduled to begin.
Yep.
That's insane. It's like, here's your script. We start in 2 days. Other actors, none of these are going to have a lot. Norman Barthold, he's mostly television. However, he was in Close Encounters, and he played the president in Capricorn 1.
Back to Capricorn 1.
Yeah, he was the medieval knight. Alan Oppenheimer. Do you recognize his name? I know you recognize his face.
I knew him because I know this guy because he has like a gajillion freaking animation credits. He is a voice actor from hell.
He has 335 acting credits.
Yeah.
That's more than double what James Brolin has.
Oh, yeah. He's done just seasons and seasons of voice acting. I know that.
He has.
He's done a bunch.
He's also pretty much a television actor. However, he was in Freaky Friday. He's a very recognizable face because he was in a lot of 70s television shows. Mm-hmm. And he is the chief supervisor, and probably the biggest gripe I have about this movie is his plot. Where they're all trapped in the room and the air conditioner is not working. I just think that's kind of stupid.
Well, yeah, the air doesn't work, but all the panels do and all the monitors do.
Right, and we're all going to suffocate and die in here, and y'all are going to, you know, we can't fix Westworld. It's like a big Deus Ex Machina. I don't know even how to explain it. It's just a really bad plot contrivance for trying to make it seem like there's no way they can control what's going on.
That and
we're locked in this room. We're locked in this room. It's just stupid.
Yeah, and what's his name? Robert Foxworth or whomever. The guy that's always ordering the food instead of paying attention to his console.
It's not Robert Foxworthy. I don't even have whoever it is but, in my credits. But
you know, but he's the one that's doing the really fake arm hit on the door. Like he's trying to break out. And you're right. Going, dude, that looks so horrible.
Yeah.
Please let us stuntman do that.
I was going to say, this movie is not perfect. I mean, there are some bad parts. And to me, that's the worst.
Yeah, I agree with you. And but I also think it was, again, going back, they did it really well in the series reboot for HBO because they basically just locked the doors down. Security locked the doors down. So they're trapped in there, but they're trapped in there until the robots arrive with machine guns and they basically kill everyone in that room.
Well, and then, and also when you're doing it as advanced as HBO was, it would be like these airlock seal electronic doors that are thick as bank vaults. This is just a fucking door. I mean, it's just nothing.
Yeah. It's. I was going, that whole subplot did not work at all. That was not a good way to do that. Yeah.
I have Victoria Shaw played the medieval queen, very little, mostly television. Dick Van Patten is in this movie, very much like Alan Oppenheimer. He was in Freaky Friday 2, so we have some overlap there.
Well, his thing was 8 is Enough, right? Wasn't it?
His big one was 8 is Enough. He played the father on that. However, he was in Soylent Green, too, which is on our list. I have that down. But he is mostly known for television.
I did like that progression because we had seen him earlier be the nebbish kind of guy when they were trying to pick, when they were on the hovercraft. And then when they're all experiencing the women, he's learning how to draw his gun and ends up shooting the mirror. But then there's just that little scene at CNC where you hear just, cause you're always hearing that background kind of stuff of them going, well, you want to, you know, bring up Sector 5, all that. And you hear the guy going, well, yeah, of course. If he wants to be the sheriff, he can be the sheriff. He can be anything he wants. And then it cuts and he walks out.
It's cool, great because it's after they blow up the jail. And get Richard Benjamin out. They kill the sheriff and then Dick Van Patten becomes the new sheriff in town.
Yeah.
And it's a good transition. It's very Barney Fife-ish almost.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because he's clearly not sheriff material, but now he is. Yeah.
That's a great key. I've got in my notes, I'm sorry, if I'm paying $1,000 a day, I am not spending it in jail.
So I know that's what I thought.
A storyline that gets me the frick out because I'm not going to be in jail. I have that in my notes. That, you know, the equivalent of $1,000 a day is in today's currency?
A million.
$6,849 a day. Would you pay that to go to Disney? No?
No.
You probably would.
I don't pay. We don't go to Disney. We go to Disney all the time now because we have a timeshare, but we don't go to parks that often anymore because they're just too expensive. And we know them like the back of our hand. So unless there's something new there or something that entices us, we're not going to give them $150.
That makes sense. Yeah.
We enjoy it for what it is. Or if we take friends there that have never been, we'll go.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how we do that. I have one last thing on casting that I know you know, and that is that keen observers of this movie would spot Majel Barrett, who was cast as the robotic brothel keeper. I think I have a picture of her.
Yeah, she's the madam. That they go to see.
It's hard to see in the dark. Actually, she's not in that shot, so never mind.
That's the hookers.
Yeah, Majel Barrett, of course, played Nurse Chapel on Star Trek and was married to Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
So that's a very minor casting thing, but of note, probably more so than Alan Oppenheimer. awards. Do I have any? Yes, I do. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror nominated this for Best Science Fiction Film. I should have looked to see what won. I don't know what else came out in 73 other than The Exorcist. Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers nominated for Best Dramatic Presentation, and the Hugo Awards nominated for Best Dramatic Presentation. The Avoriaz Fantastic Film Festival. I've mentioned that a few times. It's in Europe.
Yep.
They nominated it for grand prize. It won nothing. And it is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. And I kind of understand that. So
I kind of understand that. Yeah. Yeah. Although it is impactful now, but yeah.
Well, and it was impactful on our childhood, but it's more for nostalgic reasons, I would say.
Before we jump to keys and finish up, I've got just some notes, watch notes and production or trivia, and you probably have some trivia too.
I have one, I think.
This movie, like I said, is set in the near future of 1973. It's set in 1983. So this movie was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Set in a world 40 years ago. We'll do the same thing when we do Logan's Run.
What's funny is we've already done a top five of 1983 too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was not happening when we went, when that was done.
I do have some cool things. This was, we said that this was the first use of image processing, but it was also the first like mainstream reference to a computer virus, which remember in 73, that we didn't even have freaking computers. They were the size of an office building and IBM owned and all. But suddenly in this time frame, they're talking about a virus that goes through machines. And they're talking about how ridiculous that is, but it seems like it's happening, blah, blah, blah. We also have the first reference to what we nowadays in, you know, in modern times are calling the singularity, meaning when we will reach a point where machines are designing machines better than us, kind of thing, or machines designing other machines. And he even references that. He goes, most of the technology that you're seeing in Westworld are in Delos's Park. We didn't even design. It was designed by other machines. And that's why they're struggling to get control of this, these anomalies that are happening, because they didn't design them in the first place. So I thought that was kind of, that's really some breathtaking science fiction for 1973 and a television movie, essentially.
I only have one trivia thing, and that is, and I lifted this from IMDb because I found it fascinating, that several injuries occurred when making this movie. I mean, you always hear about stuntmen and Westerns getting hurt, but these weren't necessarily fighting injuries. During a shootout, a little piece of wadding from a blank cartridge got Yul Brynner in the eye. Did you read that?
No.
Yeah. Makes and sense. It kind of conflicted because he couldn't wear his famous contact lenses, you know, that made his eyes look silver like that. So they were having to film around that until his eye healed. But also, and this is fascinating to me, but that scene where James Brolin's character gets bitten by the robot rattlesnake, that was a real rattlesnake, and it really bit him.
Ooh, I didn't know that. That's cool. Yes. Did they want it to bite him? Or?
No. Well, he didn't.
Well, I mean, but, did they rig it up so it would bite like into well, a
it
pad
said
or
while
something.
It was a milked rattlesnake, so it had been milked of poison, but it was attached to Brolin's arm and he was bitten by the lower fangs on the low, you know, the lower part of the,
okay,
the snake jaw, even through the padding and the cotton on his arm. So he fucking got bit by a rattlesnake while making this movie. I think that's crazy.
That's a story to tell. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So that's the trivia I have. You got more?
It's interesting because you didn't mention the burn stunt. This has one of the longest and best burn stunts in a long time in movies. And it's very well done, but no one was injured for that, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But it's a really good stunt with the fire when he torches when he tortures the gunslinger or the Yul Brynner character.
And you know, when I was a kid, that would have been a scene that I would have remembered because it was the jump scare at the end when the burnt robot reaches out.
Yeah.
But by today's standards, it's kind of lame. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of a setup now because they do that big traveling shot following him and you know something's going to happen.
Right.
You just know something's going to happen.
It's like you think he's all burned up like Michael Myers in Halloween 2. And no, he still has enough energy to stand up, reach out before he falls over and dies. Yeah.
Yeah. I also struggle logically with this story the same way I did actually in the HBO thing, which is And this is something for everybody out there. I could not find it. I started looking, but I distinctly remember a scene where after the bar fight, Blaine and the lead guy, you know, Brolin and Benjamin are walking up because they're going back to the hotel from the bar and they're walking for the brothel and they're walking up the street and Yul Brynner's character comes out, blah, blah, blah. But before that, it's a long shot of them walking and you see one of those guns come up into frame and a hand come up and tear off the sensor the little bulb on the end of the barrel that heats, because he says earlier it won't shoot anything with heat, right? You can shoot any inanimate object, which are robots, right?
And it rips it off. And like you would tell him to shoot you. Go ahead, shoot me.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no.
but he tears it off. And that was not in any print I could find of this. I couldn't find any version that has that shot. And I swear to God, I saw it.
I think I have a reason for it.
Okay.
I bet you money it was on the television show and you saw it there.
Probably a television version. Yeah. They added it because MGM had control of that. So editing and changing. And
I'm sure you watched it.
I'm sure I did too several times, but that may make sense. But I have the same, okay, that makes perfect sense. You can create a weapon that will not fire at a human. So, A, not just the fact that, because you could always program the robots don't shoot at humans or always miss when you shoot at a human, but you can't program another human not to shoot another human. So if I don't know who's a robot and who's not, I could just be shooting anybody.
And why would you give robots real guns? Just give them blanks.
Well, because it could be, but you have to, they're shooting at other stuff, not just people. They're knocking, you can't have squibs on every glass or window or bottle or whatever. So they have to be able to projectile something. Anyway, my concept is it makes sense that you could program a weapon to not fire at another human, but there is no way you can program hands not to hit other humans or swords not to pierce other humans or knives or anything else. And so there's no way you can maintain safety in any of these parks because one human dickhead is going to start bullying some other human guest and hit him in the face. And it's going to happen. So it's kind of like, I guess that's in your insurance rider, another human mate. We can guarantee our robots won't hit you, but somebody else might.
Yeah. We neglected to mention that there is a small, and I mean minuscule, subplot in this movie to show that the robots are not only going bad in Westworld, they're going bad in the other worlds as well. And it has to do with that other guy that's on the hovercraft. He is in medieval world and he gets stabbed by the Black Knight.
Well, before that, he gets rebuffed by a wench. She refuses his sexual advances and slaps him and leaves the room.
Oh, that's right. That's right. There's that too.
Mm-hmm. And they say, that's never happened before. Why? How? She can't refuse a guest.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Which is very Nolan. I mean, because that's kind of the stuff that's happening in the Christopher Nolan version too.
Yeah. The whole Nolan version plays the concept from the robot's point of view, though. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it so interesting. It's, have you ever questioned the nature of your reality? Maybe you are a robot kind of thing. I've got just a couple more that are in there. The hand sensor I mentioned. You can't injure another guest, but yes, you can. okay. A couple of questions. So, which world would you pick? If you have these three and you could go into this ultimate immersive world of robots, where would you go?
Probably the Roman world because it's more sexual oriented. Every time you ask me a question about robots, I always go straight to sex.
You go to Greek world. Is that what you're talking
right.
about? No. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Roman.
Well, interesting. I would probably pick medieval world. Because of the knights and the chivalry and everything, so it makes sense. That's really interesting. I also had the question of,
I could lay around in a bath and just fool around with people all day. So.
You could just Caligula your butt off over there, right? Yeah.
Boy, bring me those grapes.
Bring me those grapes. Naked, please. Yeah. okay. So another question. Maybe it's just me and help me understand this. And I don't want to offend anybody or be, whatever, but
I'm offended.
Does Brenner strike you as kind of gay in this movie? From the very beginning, he walks gay. He acts kind of.
He walks like he's got something stuck up his butt. He does walk.
He
funny.
Does. He has this kind of wiggle walk kind of thing that he's doing. Is that wrong for me to say? It just kind of hit me that way. I was going, he's kind of walking gay, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any people that are tuning in as for the first time, I'm gay and I'm not offended at all by that.
Okay.
Good. I don't interpret it as gay, but now you've got me reevaluating. Like, did I miss something? Because I don't. I think to me what it is Yul Brynner is not a cowboy. I mean, he really is not the – I know he was in the Magnificent Seven, but he is forever associated with playing Ramses in Ten Commandments and a Chinese – I guess Chinese king or Siamese king maybe in The King and I. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, he just doesn't look like a cowboy, and he walks funny. Cowboys don't walk like that. Cowboys walk kind of lazy and sluggishly, and he walks kind of like, I don't know, like he's – holding that chest out, and cowboys really don't. I don't know. He just doesn't.
Kevin Costner walks like a cowboy. You know, Yul Brynner doesn't. I agree with that. Right. Yeah,
right.
Same thing. I think that he's always, even his enunciation and his intonation, and everything else. Would you design a gunslinger cowboy like that? Probably not.
No, you wouldn't design him bald either.
No, you would go with a Tommy Lee Jones kind of character, you know, kind of attitude and everything. So I thought that was interesting. And again, MGM casting who they can, getting somebody that will be a draw or whatever, trying to do it that way, I guess, was the token of that. And my last little trivia or behind the scenes or whatever is that, the original ending that he actually wanted to film, but they cut and had to rewrite and change, was that the gunslinger ended up dying on the rack in Medieval World.
Oh, and that's Crichton, cool.
Crichton wanted this whole concept of a very, very, very complex machine being destroyed by an extremely simple machine.
And like pulled apart.
Pulled apart.
Yeah, that'd be great, man. Totally get that.
I thought it was a great idea, and I was going, why did you cut that? That works for me.
Yeah. It wouldn't be gory, so they could have showed it all because it would be robotic parts being pulled.
Oh, yeah,
apart.
All the sparks and
right. Oh, yeah, that would have been cool. Awesome.
Yeah, would have been cool.
But before we move on, if that was your last, before we move on to keys, I have something to ask you. What do you think, and I'm bearing Coma in mind too, since I talked about Coma, what do you think about Michael Crichton as a director?
Remember, as a director, I don't like him as a director.
I don't think he's good. And I think he finally came to terms with that and started letting people just do his stuff, like Spielberg with Jurassic Park.
Which makes sense. I mean, I think he may have always wanted to. I think he has some brilliant ideas. I've always liked his ideas and his science fiction attitude and the fact of technology. The biggest key from this is Jurassic, of course, because Jurassic is the ultimate embodiment of an amusement park of, you know, taken amok.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
He's obsessed with amusement parks. It's clear Michael Crichton is obsessed with amusement parks.
Yes. All the way through, I mean, his career sort of thing. But I think he directs very straightforward, very flat, and has terrible pacing. The bar fight in this could have been cut by a third and still work. It goes on way too long with way too many stunts and way too much stuff and slow motion and everything. You're going, this doesn't help the plot at all. It's just a freaking fight that really has nothing to do with the story. All you need to do is get these guys to be quiet for one night so the gunslinger can shoot the guy the next morning while everything's going crazy in Roman land. You know, that didn't work for me. The pacing alone in the chase, I think, goes on a little too long.
Okay.
You know,
I think he got better with suspense. Like I said, the last half of Coma is very suspenseful, and I bought into it.
And I think so Coma had better production values. He does a lot better with lighting and the way Coma is lit, and him crawling in those, you know, up above the room, and the way the room is lit with the hanging bodies and all that. That was really cool. Mm-hmm. Runaway is the same way. Runaway has really good cinematography, but I don't necessarily like that acting or cast or story.
No, that is a horrible movie. I think it's the last movie he ever did before he hung it up.
Well, Looker is the same way. Great ideas, again, with synthetic people and or taking over bodies, that kind of shtick that he's doing as Crichton, but not great. a great movie.
You know, Looker may be on our list. I think I should add Runaway to our list, even though we know how bad it is, because that would be worth covering for a laugh. I mean,
that would be a fun bad movie.
Yes. He basically took Tom Selleck, who he had worked with in Coma, and put him up against Gene Simmons of Kiss, and Gene Simmons cannot fucking act, and it is terrible. I went and saw that movie in the theater with David Farmer, and we almost walked out. We were like, this is awful.
Oh, yeah.
It was so bad.
But, you know, when you see Gene Simmons, you think terrorist. You know?
I think I'm scared of that hairdo, that funky, yeah. weird hair. It looks like a helmet.
It was awful. It was so bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Very bad. So, all right. Well, Keith? I was curious, though, as far as the directing aspect, what you thought of.
Yeah, I do not think he's a good director. Okay. No.
Yeah. Keys. Oh, my God. Well, I'll go ahead and lead off because we've already said it. Disneyland or Walt Disney, Jurassic Park, anything that has to do with a theme park, you can tell Michael Crichton has – it's one of those things like writers get under their skin and can't seem to shake – in different books. And, you know, obviously he has written more than one theme park run amok story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge key.
And I have a tag on to that. Michael Crichton has said that one of his inspirations for this story was Pirates of the Caribbean, The Ride.
Yes. I forgot about that.
And again, Disney. But the animatronics and using that as an entertainment is what hooked him and was a key influence on him developing this story. I also have other keys coming from Jurassic, which are two elements that are also in most of his stories, which are corporate greed is the bad villain overall and not listening to scientists.
Yeah.
And those are two key elements in all of Crichton's works. Even Coma. Coma's the same way. It's a big corporate greed body farming operation thing.
Actually, it's just a hospital, but it's a big corporate hospital. I mean,
yeah, it's a corporate hospital.
It's a major hospital. Yeah.
Right. Let's see, keys. We've listed the three we talked. Go ahead.
Well, one that obviously, and this is just a given, anyone would get this. Is going to be Terminator because it's a robot chasing a man at the end, and it's like a stalker movie. Except, you know, of course, he's chasing Sarah Connor in the original Terminator. However, being me and the horror aspect, I'm going to relate it even further to slasher movies. This movie is just like Halloween or Friday the 13th. I can't say it. Speak. Either of those movies where a masked killer or a stalker is chasing someone down. And that's what the latter half of this movie is. It's a slasher movie, basically a stalker movie.
And I've got that. 78ers, yeah. Slasher monsters, Halloween, Jason, Freddy, all of them. Yeah. The fact that the hero is our heroine, and usually in the slasher cases, is trying everything they can to survive, and they're just proceeding at their own pace, just going. Even down to, you know, what's the if you have sex, it'll chase you movie?
Friday the 13th is the one where if you have sex, you die.
No, the newer one. We just did it a couple of years
ago. Oh, It Follows.
It Follows. Yeah.
Okay.
Same thing. You know, the heroine is trying to outrun this person the entire, you know, most That's the bulk of the kid. Movie, and they're just going at their own pace, and they will eventually catch up, and they will find you eventually.
Yeah, that's a very, very good key, actually.
Yeah, you had my exact same. I've got the typical ones that came from it, of course. Future World was the direct sequel produced by AIP. Then they had a limited television series called Beyond Westworld, and then the Nolan and Joy reboot, which was called Westworld again. You had mentioned $6 Million Man, and especially when the Goldman robots or whatever got into that whole backstory in season two or three of that series.
I mean, I can go even further. I mean, the sets look like $6 Million Man. The computers look like $6 Million Man.
Yep.
The robotic effects look like $6 Million Man. I'm pretty sure Alan Oppenheimer was in $6 Million Man because he was in everything else back then. This movie reeks of $6 Million Man to me.
Definitely. Yeah. I've got a past and a couple of pasts and a future. So I've got pasts. I've got Star Trek in the original series in two references. One, Where No Man Has Gone Before with the silver eyes. And, you know, he used silver contacts in this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when Gary Mitchell changed, he had the silver eyes. And then so did she when she changed. And one we covered just recently on Thy Lithium Chamber, iMUD, because it has androids. They're all androids. And the way they expose the android at the beginning in the teaser is he pulls his tunic up and opens up his chest and he has those little controls going whirring and blurring and everything.
Isn't MUD's women that way too? Isn't that androids? Aren't they androids?
No, MUD's women is the chemical that makes them seductive. iMUD is they're all androids. Okay. They're all matching androids. Yeah. Right, and I also have another reference to, and I didn't research it, but I think it's 60s or early 70s. Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machines are all
Is that the
female,
one with Vincent Price?
Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And they have
We talked
female,
about that not long ago.
Yeah. For Dr. Fives or what? No, for Tingler. Female robots in it. And that led as a direct key influence to Austin Powers and his female robots that have gun barrels for nipples and stuff. Yeah.
It wasn't during Tingler that we talked about it. We talked about it during Black Sabbath because
Black Sabbath, yeah.
We were talking about the relationship between Bava and Christopher Lee and Vincent Price and Boris Karloff. And we had mentioned that, like, Christopher Lee worked with Bava on something and Vincent Price was Bava was attached to the Goldfoot thing and then got fired and but Vincent Price ended up in it. I don't know. It was just like a lot of incestuous Italian / spy thriller crap going on with our favorite horror actors, basically.
Yep.
But I do remember us talking about that. I have what else do I have? We mentioned Jurassic Park. Oh, okay, here's the one. The Dark Tower. Stephen King.
Mm. Okay.
The villain in this movie is referred to simply as the Gunslinger. And that is the main character
right.
from the Dark Tower.
Duh, David. Duh. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, so you know I'm going to go to Stephen King.
You had said Magnificent Seven referring to Yul Brynner. It actually is a key because two of the producers of this said they wanted to use the same character that Brynner played in Magnificent Seven, even down to we want the same black costume. And that's what he wears. He wears the
yeah,
same
he wears costume. His exact same costume. I knew that.
Yeah.
I had Sam Peckinpah down. I don't know if either outweigh the other, but yeah, because there's definitely keys to Sam Peckinpah in this.
Oh, yeah. It's like you said, the way he shoots the spaghetti western parts, it's not just one gunshot with a squib. It's three with blood paint pouring out and fall down in slow motion. All that is very Peckinpah.
Yeah,
sure. All the violence and the smoke, you know, the squibs mm-hmm. and all that has to be there.
And slow-mo. A lot of slow-mo, too.
A key within a key in, and I think it's in the first season of Westworld's, HBO Westworld, they go to an old version of the park that's down underground. The Delos logo is done in the same font style as Westworld is on the novel
from
and the poster.
From the 70s, yeah.
And you just get a glimpse of it, but you were following a character and they're walking along and they're walking along and we're watching them. But in the background, out of focus, so you can barely see it, is this dark silhouette. And it is the Gunslinger from Westworld in the background. It is Yul Brynner's character as a deactivated robot in the background.
That's awesome.
And they directly do that as like an homage. And it's nothing's said about it. Nothing's done with it. It's just there if you notice it.
No, it's great. It's really
which
cool.
Which is great.
And I watched – was this first season?
Yes, season one.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw first season. I never saw another one, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Season two, not as good, but kind of good. Season three, not good. Season four, really bad, unfortunately. So, sorry, you know. When you get down to season three and there's only one good episode out of eight, that sucks. Sorry, guys. But
I don't really have any other keys. I mean, I'm not going to get into every Western ever made or every slasher movie ever made. But, I mean, I think we've hit it pretty well.
I have one last key that was directly influenced by this and is so good. And it is a BBC series called Humans.
You've mentioned that before.
Yeah, it only had, I think, two seasons. But it is so good with this whole androids as part of our life and how they could essentially help and or hurt. And are they sentient or not? Do they have their own sentient? I mean, if we, you know, we don't want to get into all the every time they've used a robot in a movie, because then you get into like Megan and all that other stuff. But it's essentially the same thing. How do we?
Megan would be a little key, though, now that I think about
it. It would. I mean, how do we integrate with this technology, and how does it integrate with us, and how do we repurpose it? And yeah, I guarantee once we get to the point, we will have robots as slaves. That's where they will be for us. They will be our butlers. They will be our chauffeurs. They will be our taxi drivers. They will be our, you know, go to the store for us. And eventually that will be a bad thing.
Yeah, because slavery is not good.
But is a machine a slave? So yes. Is your car a slave? So your car is a slave for you?
A car doesn't really have a conscience.
Neither will these. They won't have conscience.
How
they
do you
will
know,
just,
David?
Well, I know. That's the kind of the sci-fi point. That's what we love debating about. Is, yes, they will. The more human they are, the more likely they are to have a conscience or be sentient. And then they should not be enslaved.
No.
But we will do that to them. We will make them sex slaves first, and we will go from there.
There you go. And there will be actors that can't get work that will be licensing their images to be sex slaves.
And as you are floating in your bath eating your grapes, you will think, is this a bad thing? Should I be doing this or not? You
know. No, not at all. Well, all right. I think that's going to do it for our coverage of today's topic, Westworld.
Yes.
Our fourth of five October movies. Next week will be even closer to Halloween. It may even be after Halloween. But anyway, we have one more Halloween movie for you. I'd like to take this moment just to remind you folks out there that are watching us. If you've never been to our website, go to our website. There you will find a list of every movie we've done per season. You can listen to them there like a podcast, or you can, you know, just pick and choose, because a lot of people don't want to listen to movies if it's a movie. I mean, listen to a podcast if it's a movie they don't particularly are interested in. Anyway,
true.
You can go there and get a lot of information on us and on the films we've covered. We would appreciate it if you're watching us on YouTube today to subscribe. Anything you can do, thumbs up, rank us, rate us, podcast or YouTube. It helps us immensely as far as getting our gospel of movie lore out there.
And if you've done it before, do it again. If you've ranked us or liked us or whatever, do it again. It always helps us.
Yeah, absolutely. And if that is not enough for you and you want more of us besides all these YouTube shows and our podcast, we do have a Patreon. It has bonus episodes. It has some free stuff. It has some subscription-based stuff. And the subscription-based stuff includes two other shows based on television shows. Star Trek, the original series. We've done almost two seasons of that. And X-Files, the original series. And we've almost done two seasons of that. So there's plenty of material over there as well. Yeah. And I guess until next week, when we'll be back in Scary Land.
Yes, thank you for at least picking a few science fiction for our October world. And next week, I'll be frightened again. So we'll go there.
Yes, you will be frightened, and I will be leading you there. And I will see you then.
See you then.
Alrighty, bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Johnny Has the Keys. You can learn more about us at our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and our Facebook page. Avoid missing shows by subscribing on iTunes and Google Play, and please, please like, rate, and review us. We're doing this for genre geeks like ourselves, and we can't continue without your support. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.